Rohan's words were prophetic. There were identical envelopes addressed to each of them lying at their places on the dining room table the next morning when they came down to breakfast. Nicholas opened his as he ordered coffee from the waiter in his ankle-length chamois, and his expression changed as he read the note. "Hello," he exclaimed. "We made an even bigger impression on the boys in blue than we realized. General Obaid wants to see me again." He read aloud from the note. "You are ordered to present yourself at police headquarters at or before noon." Nicholas whistled softly. "Strong language. No please or thank you." "Mine is identical." Rohan glanced at the note on an official police letterhead. "What on earth do you suppose it means?" "We'll find out soon enough," Nicholas promised her. "But it sounds a little ominous. Methinks the love affair is over." This morning, when they arrived at police headquarters, there was no reception committee to welcome them. The guard at the private entrance sent them around to the general charge office, where they were involved in a long, confused discussion with the desk officer, who had only a rudimentary knowledge of English. From previous experience in Africa, Nicholas knew better than to lose his temper, or even to let his irritation show. Finally, the desk officer held a long, whispered telephone conversation with some unknown person, at the end of which he waved them airily towards a hard wooden bench against the far wall. "You wait. Man comes soon." For the next 40 minutes they shared their seat with a colourful selection of other supplicants, applicants, complainants, and petty criminals. One or two of them were bleeding copiously from assault by persons unknown, and yet others were in manacles. "It seems our star is on the wane," Nicholas remarked, as he held a handkerchief to his nose. It was obvious that some of his neighbours had not had a close acquaintanceship with soap and water for some time. "No more VIP treatment." At the end of 40 minutes, Inspector Gulla, who had treated them so deferentially the day before, looked over the partition and beckoned to them in a high-handed fashion. He ignored Nicholas's outstretched right hand and led them through to one of the back rooms. There he did not offer them a seat, but addressed Nicholas coldly. "You are responsible for the loss of a firearm that was in your possession." "That is correct. As I explained to you in my statement yesterday..." Inspector Gulla cut him off. "The loss of a firearm due to negligence is a very serious offence," he said severely. "There was no negligence on my part," Nicholas denied. "You left the firearm unguarded. You made no attempt to lock it in a steel safe. That is negligence." "With respect, Inspector, there is a notable dearth of steel safes in the Abbey Gorge." "Negligence," Gulla repeated. "Criminal negligence. How are we to know that the weapon has not fallen into the hands of elements opposed to the government?" "You mean some unknown person may overthrow the government with a 275 Rigby?" Nicholas smiled. Inspector Gulla ignored the sally and produced two documents from the drawer of his desk. "It is my duty to serve these deportation orders on both you and Dr. Alsima. You have 24 hours to leave Ethiopia, and thereafter you will be considered to be prohibited immigrants, both of you." "Dr. Alsima has not lost any weapons," Nicholas pointed out mildly. "In fact, as far as I am aware, she has never been even mildly negligent in her entire life." And again his comment was ignored. "Please sign here to acknowledge that you have received and understood the orders." "I would like to speak to General Obaid, the Commissioner of Police," said Nicholas. "General Obaid left this morning for an inspection tour of the northern frontier districts. He will not return to Addis Ababa for some weeks." "By which time we will be safely back in England?" "Exactly," Inspector Gulla smiled for the first time, a thin, wintry smirk. "Please sign here and here." "What happened?" Rohan demanded, as the driver opened the door of the rolls for her and she settled into the seat beside Nicholas. "It was all so sudden and unexpected. One moment everybody loved us, and the next we are being booted down the stairs." "Do you want my guess?" Nicholas asked, and then went on without waiting for her reply. "Nogo is not the only one in Pegasus' back pocket. Overnight, Obaid has been in contact with von Schiller and received his orders." "Do you realize what this means, Nicky? It means that we will not be able to return to Ethiopia. That puts the tomb of Mamose beyond our grasp. She stared at him with large, dark eyes full of dismay. When Duryed and I visited Iraq and Libya, neither of us had letters of invitation from either Saddam or Gaddafi, as I recall. You look delighted at the prospect of breaking the law, she accused. You're smirking all over your face. After all, it is only Ethiopian law, he pointed out virtuously, not to be taken too seriously. And it will be an Ethiopian prison they toss you into. That you can take seriously. You too, he grinned, if they catch us. You can be certain that H.E. has already registered a formal complaint with the President's office, Jeffrey told them as he drove them to the airport the next day. He's most upset at the whole business, I can tell you. Deportation orders and all that rot, never heard the likes. Don't fuss yourself, old boy, Nicholas told him. As it is, neither of us intends coming back here again. No harm done. It's the principle of the thing. Prominent British subject being treated like a common criminal. No respect shown, he sighed. Sometimes I wish I had been born 100 years ago. We wouldn't have to put up with this sort of nonsense. Just send a gunboat. Quite so, Geoffrey. But please, don't let it upset you. Geoffrey hovered around them like a cat with kittens while they checked in at the Kenya Airways counter. They had only their hand luggage, 2 small cheap nylon holdalls that they had brought that morning at a street market. Nicholas had rolled his dick-dick skin into a ball and wrapped it in an embroidered shammah that he had purchased in the same market. Geoffrey waited with them until their flight was called and waved to them after they passed through the barrier, aiming this affectionate display more at Royan than at Nicholas. They had been allocated seats behind the wing, and Royan was beside the window. The Kenya Airways plane started its engines and began to taxi slowly past the airport buildings. Nicholas was arguing with a stewardess who wanted him to stow his precious dick-dick skin in its purple nylon bag in the overhead locker, while Rayanne peered out of the porthole beside her for her last glimpse of Addis during takeoff. Suddenly, Rayanne stiffened in her seat, and while still gazing out of the window, reached across and seized Nicholas's arm. Look! She hissed with such venom in her tone that he leaned across her to see what had excited her. Pegasus, she exclaimed, and pointed to the Falcon executive jet that had just taxied in and parked at the far end of the airport buildings. The small, sleek aircraft was painted green, and on its tall tail fin the scarlet horse reared on its hind legs in that stylized pose. While they watched through the window, the door in the fuselage of the green Falcon was lowered, and a small reception committee waiting on the tarmac pressed forward expectantly to greet the passengers as they appeared in the doorway of the jet. The first of these was a small man, neatly dressed, in a cream tropical suit and a white Panama straw hat. Despite his size, he exuded an air of confidence and command, that special aura of power. His face was pale, as though he had come from a northern winter, and it looked incongruous in this setting. His jaw was firm and stubborn, his nose prominent, and his gaze, beneath dark, beetling eyebrows, penetrating. Nicholas recognised him immediately. He had seen him often enough on the auction floors at Sotheby's and Christie's. This man was not the type of person whom anyone would forget in a hurry. "Von Schiller," he exclaimed, as the German surveyed with an imperial gaze the men who waited on the tarmac below him. "He looks like a bantam rooster," Ryan murmured. "Or a standing cobra." Von Schiller raised his Panama hat and ran down the steps of the Falcon with a light, athletic tread, and Nicholas said quietly, "You wouldn't think that he was almost 70." "He moves like a man of 40," Ryan agreed. "He must dye his hair and eyebrows. See how dark they are." "My oath!" Nicholas was startled. "Look who's here to greet him." There was a glint of sunlight on decorations and regimental insignia. A tall figure in blue uniform detached itself from the welcoming group and touched the shiny patent leather brim of his cap in a respectful salute before taking von Schiller's hand and shaking it cordially. Your erstwhile admirer, General Obaid. No wonder he could not meet us yesterday. He was much too busy. Look, Nicky, Ryan gasped. She was no longer watching the pair at the foot of the steps, who were still clasping hands as they chatted with animation. Her whole attention was focused on the top of the steps of the Falcon jet, where another younger man had appeared. He was bareheaded, and Nicholas had the impression of sallow skin and dense, dark, wavy hair. Never seen him before in my life. Who is he? Nicholas asked her. Nahut Gudabi, Duryad's assistant from the museum. The man who now has his job. As Nahut started down the steps of the Falcon, their own aircraft trundled on down the tarmac, then swung out onto the main taxiway and blocked any further view of the gathering beside the Pegasus jet. Both of them fell back in their seats and stared at each other for a long moment. Nicholas recovered his voice first. A witch's Sabbath. A convocation of the ugly ones. We were lucky to witness it. There are no more secrets now. We know very clearly who the opposition is. Von Schiller is the puppet master, she agreed, breathless with anger and horror. But Nahut Gudabi is his hunting dog. Nahut must be the one who hired the killers in Cairo and turned them loose on us. Oh, God, Nicky, you should have heard him at the funeral going on about how much he admired and respected Duryad, the filthy, murderous hypocrite. And they were both silent until the aircraft had taken off and climbed to cruise altitude. Then Ryan said quietly, Of course you were right about Obaid. He is deep in Von Schiller's pocket also. He may simply have been acting as the representative of the Ethiopian government, paying respect to a major foreign concession holder, somebody who they hope is going to discover fabulous copper deposits in their poverty-stricken country and make them all rich. She shook her head firmly. If it was as simple as that, it would be one of the cabinet ministers meeting him, not the chief of police. No, Obaid has the stink of treachery on him, just the same as Nahut. Seeing her husband's killers in the flesh had reopened the half-healed wounds of Royan's grief and mourning. These bitter emotions were a flame that was burning her up, like the bushfire in the trunk of a hollow forest tree, consuming her from within. Nicholas knew that he could not quench that flame, that he could only hope to distract her for a while. He talked to her quietly, turning her dark thoughts away from death and vengeance, to the challenge of Taita's game and the riddle of the lost tomb. By the time that they had changed planes at Nairobi and landed at Heathrow the following morning, the two of them had sketched out a plan of action for their return to the Nile Gorge and the exploration of Taita's pool in the chasm. But although now Royan appeared on the surface to be her usual calm and cheerful self once again, Nicholas knew that the pain of her loss was still there beneath the surface. They landed at Heathrow so early that they walked through the immigration gates without running into a queue, and since they had no bags in the hold, they did not have to play the customary game of roulette at the luggage carousel. Will they arrive or won't they? Carrying the Dick skin in the nylon bag under his arm, and with Royan limping on her cane on his other arm, Nicholas sauntered through the green channel of HM Customs, as innocent as a cherub from the roof of the Sistine Chapel. "You are so brazen," she whispered to him once they were through and clear. "If you can lie so convincingly to customs, how can I ever trust you again?" Their luck held. There was no queue at the taxi rank, and in a little over an hour after touchdown, the taxi deposited them on the pavement outside Nicholas's townhouse in Knightsbridge. It was only 8:30 on a Monday morning. While Royan showered, Nicholas went down to the corner shop under an umbrella to fetch some groceries. Then they shared the task of cooking breakfast, Royan taking care of the toast while Nicholas whipped up his speciality, a herb omelette. "Surely you're going to need expert help when we go back to the Abbey Gorge," Royan observed, as she let the butter melt into the hot toast. "I already have the right man in mind. I've worked with him before," he told her. "Ex-Royal Engineers, expert in diving and underwater construction. Retired and living in a little cottage in Devon, I suspect he's a little short of the ready and bored out of his considerable mind. I expect him to jump at any opportunity to alleviate either condition.